Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. So we begin today's Triangle Business Journal by looking at the biz page, which is a quick glance at Triangle happenings. Several articles on this page. The first one is, We'll Drink to That. The wine event with Coach K raises millions for the V Foundation. The bond between two of the Triangle's great basketball coaches, Mike Krzyzewski and Jim Valvano, continued earlier this month with a wine celebration to raise money for Valvano's fight to end cancer. Krzyzewski, the coach at Duke University, became exceptionally close to Valvano when the NC State University coach had cancer. Since Valvano died in 1993, Krzyzewski has been active in the V Foundation for Cancer Research. Krzyzewski, a noted wine aficionado, hosted the 19th annual V Foundation Wine Celebration August 3rd through the 6th in California's Napa Valley. The event raised $9 million. I'm here because Jimmy recruited me, Krzyzewski said. He had a vision, divine intervention in what happened to him. And in the endorsed front, Mayo brand gets a boost from North Carolina chef. Seems like all roads lead to the Triangle or really close to it. Biz was taking a lazy Sunday afternoon recently to decompress, watch a little TV, and up popped a familiar face. Chef Vivian Howard, owner of Chef and the Farmer and the Boiler Room, both based in Kinston, and host of the PBS show A Chef's Life. Turns out Howard was pitching Duke's mayonnaise, saying in the ad that it's the perfect companion to any meal. Makes a tomato taste more like a tomato. It makes bacon taste more like bacon, she expresses in the ad. Okay, anything that makes bacon taste more like bacon is worth a second look, Biz thinks. Duke's is a product of the C.F. Sauer Company, located in Richmond, Virginia. Also on the Biz page, the food bank benefits from Raleigh Restaurant Week. Downtown Raleigh Restaurant Week has a new twist this year, with the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina getting some aid from the August the 21st to the 27th event. For every prefix meal sold, the food bank will get a dollar. And a dollar is a big deal to the food bank, where President and CEO Peter Wierbicki says a single dollar can provide five meals. Every dollar we manage to obtain will be multiplied five times, he tells Biz. Restaurant Week, he says, also will raise awareness that even in prosperous Wake County, there are roughly 130,000 people who are food insecure. The Restaurant Week has grown through the years. Starting in 2009, at a time when restaurants are traditionally slow, the initial effort had fewer than 30 restaurants involved. This year, there are more than 50. And Stacy Simeon of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance expects more than 4,000 reservations on OpenTable. Wierbicki says he has no idea how much the effort will raise for the food bank, which has a yearly budget of $15 million. We're very optimistic, he says. And in the athletic department comes the article, Play Ball, Different Game at Durham Bulls Athletic Park. The Durham Bulls are hosting a different sort of sport this fall. Beginning September 29, the Durham Bulls Athletic Park will host a three-day sports tournament, the DBAP Gaming Challenge. The event features a $5,000 pot across multiple tournaments, with gamers competing in a variety of contests such as Super Smash Bros. And Call of Duty. Interesting, but do we still have peanuts and Cracker Jacks? And while you're wondering about that, here comes an article about food. Local chocolate is international hit. A Cary entrepreneur who left her engineering job a few years ago to start her own chocolate making business last November is getting some international attention. Chocolatier Grace Stocker's Chocolat Grace Company entered in the 2017 edition of the London-based Academy of Chocolate Awards and took home six prizes this year, three golds, two silvers, and a bronze. Stocker won three medals in the Phil Chocolate's Alcohol Ganache category alone. She also was awarded with the International Rising Star Award. Stocker currently sells her chocolates through her website, but is ready to talk to local retailers about carrying her creations. She says she learned about chocolate in Switzerland and France at the famed Condorama of Felchelin and L'École du Grand Chocolat of Valrhona schools. Stalker, age 45, says she's only trying to develop her business now that currently has sales of less than $10,000. I'm looking for boutique realtors, boutique retailers that would carry my goods, and we can come to an arrangement regarding the margins, she says. It takes Stalker about 4 to 5 days to make the 6, 12, or 24 boxes of chocolates. But if the demand for her product increases, she says she may need assistance in fulfilling the orders. It's very rewarding, especially when you take them off the mold, and it tastes great, she says. Now moving to the real estate page. A couple of short articles here. First on stock drops, Advance Auto warns of industry headwinds. Advance Auto Parts reported a profit of $1.58 per share in the second quarter, but the results were below analyst earnings expectations of $1.65 a share. Same-store sales were flat, and the company warned that comparable store sales could be down 1-3% for the fiscal year. While we're narrowing the competitive gap versus peers, which gives us tremendous confidence in our investment, we also recognize the short-term headwind the industry is facing and have factored this into our full-year guidance, Advance Auto President and CEO Tom Greco told shareholders on the quarterly earnings conference call August the 15th. Advance Auto Parts has seen its stock price drop substantially in the last year. CEO Tom Greco has said a sustained focus on customer service will lead to a comeback. So here's a quick glimpse of how stock has fared since 2016. So all of these, let's see, August 15th of 2016, $167.49 a share. November 15th of 2016, $164.13 a share. February 15th, $163.74 a share. May 15th, $145.78. That's 15th of 2017. And then August of this year, $87.08. And in the grocery wars front comes the article, Lidl buys land for the fourth grocery store in Wake County. Lidl, the European grocery chain that made its U.S. debut over the summer, will be adding one more Triangle location to its mix, following the $3.15 million purchase of land for a new store at 528 Sudbury Drive in Cary, near the intersection of Harrison Avenue and Northeast Maynard Road in Cary. Lidl has closed on the purchase of nearly 3.5 acres, according to recently filed county records. The seller was local real estate investor George Jordan III. The grocer opened its first store in the region in Wake Forest in July, and it's building a second store on Wake Forest Road in the Raleigh area. Lidl also owns property in Apex. And in other real estate news comes the article, Historic Dorm Space Springs to Life. Duke University started moving its first wave of research scientists and staffers into the newly renovated Chesterfield, a former cigarette manufacturing plant, in late July. Justin Parker, a developer with the building's owner, Wexford Science and Technology, says a steady stream of tenants will continue moving in through early 2018. It's pretty spectacular, he says. Parker confirms a fourth local company will move into Chesterfield. Validic, a digital health technology company based in Durham, will be taking about 10,000 square feet on Chesterfield's sixth floor when the company of about 60 employees relocates later in the year. Validic is currently based on the 12th floor of the Durham Center office tower on Morgan Street. The Validic lease deal brings the building to about 85% occupancy. For years, Chesterfield had been a vacant building on a downtown Durham business client that was bustling with redevelopment opportunities. Drew Schiller, co-founder and CEO of Validic, says his growing company wanted to stay in downtown Durham. Durham has been our home from the start, he says. We intentionally set roots in Durham because the culture of the city matches the culture of our company. Moving to the Chesterfield gives us the ability to make the space ours and showcases what makes Validic unique. And in the home market front comes the article, Finding Affordable Housing Still Difficult in the Triangle. Statistical data from the National Association of Home Builders Wells Fargo Housing Opportunity Index for the second quarter shows that housing affordability ratios in the Triangle are getting worse. for the Raleigh-Cary metro area, 64% of new and existing homes sold were affordable to families earning a median household income of $80,200 for the region. For the Durham-Chapel Hill metro area, less than 67% of homes sold were affordable to families earning a median household income of $73,300. The region, however, is still tracking better than the national average, where 59.4% of new and existing homes sold in the second quarter were affordable to families earning the U.S. median income of $68,000. The overall inventory of available Triangle homes for sale in July was down 14.6% over last year, with 2.6 months' supply of inventory. Market equilibrium is usually considered to be around 6 months of supply. The story isn't that inventory is low, says Stacy Anfinson, author of the Triangle Area Real Estate Residential Realty, or TAR, report, and appraiser with Birch Appraisal Group in Cary. We have the correct inventory, except for pricing below $300,000. And on the expansion front, co-working giant WeWork to make debut in Raleigh. Popular global co-working space provider WeWork confirmed on August the 16th that it will be planning a new flag in downtown Raleigh. WeWork will be the new anchor office tenant at the 10-story One Glenwood building, now breaking ground in the fall. WeWork assigned a lease for 81,032 square feet, or about one-third of the office space planned at One Glenwood, an $86 million, 227,500 square foot office tower at the corner of Glenwood Avenue and Hillsborough Street in the Glenwood South District. The new office is expected to open in early 2019. Raleigh-Durham has always been on our radar, says Adam Wyszynski, general manager of WeWork's Southern Region. It was never a question, should we go to Raleigh? It was more finding the right building. This is going to be a brand new building, right in the heart of things in downtown. The new WeWork space will accommodate about 1,380 members and will offer a variety of workspace options for single entrepreneurs and more. Now moving to the technology section of today's Triangle Business Journal, comes the article, Records Detail Pursuit of A Wireless. A Wireless almost took its promised 250 jobs and new headquarters to Atlanta in exchange for a heftier incentives package, public records show. While both Raleigh and Atlanta were at the top of the Verizon retailer shortlist, Georgia's incentives offer at $5.2 million was actually bigger than what North Carolina ended up promising in exchange for a jobs pledge. North Carolina offered nearly $3.7 million in state incentives, including a JDIG worth more than $3.3 million. Losing the project, referred to by its codename Checkmark, would likely have meant the company would move corporate functions from North Carolina, according to more than 540 pages of documents disclosed by the North Carolina Department of Commerce at the behest of a public records request. A Wireless already has 88 positions in Pitt County. The company, according to its agreement with the state, plans to transfer 60 of those jobs to Wake County. It will then move 40 positions from, quote, an out-of-state location to Pitt County, unquote. Emails throughout the recruitment process show Commerce concerned about moving jobs from Tier 2 Pitt County to Tier 3 Wake County. To address those concerns, the final JDIG terms contained requirements about retaining jobs in Pitt County, even as the headquarters moves to Raleigh. It's a net loss of 20 jobs in Pitt County instead of 88, a July Q&A document distributed internally to Commerce reads, adding that A Wireless is required to offer Wake County jobs to those in Pitt County who are qualified. The Q&A specifically addresses why the state would fund a project that moves jobs out of a Tier 2 county. The truth is, if not for this grant, the company indicated that it would move all Pitt County jobs out of the state to Atlanta. The answer listed in the Q&A document reads, on top of what it's retaining, the company plans to create 250 new jobs statewide, the document notes. And in other news of business moving comes the article NetCertive buys Seattle tech firm. Morseful marketing technology firm NetCertive has acquired a Seattle company, and that means a new West Coast foothold, says CEO Brendan Morrissey. NetCertive announced August 15th it's acquiring Mixpo, now that's M-I-X-P-O, whose technology enables publishers and advertisers to build, manage, and measure video and rich media ad campaigns. The deal, Morrissey says, evolved from an existing relationship with Mixpo. NetCertive, whose clients include Serta and Acura, had seen increased demand in the video space and sought out partners with that expertise. A partnership with Mixpo emerged from that search, and over the past few quarters, technologies have been integrated, particularly on the video side, he says. Earlier this year, the association evolved to the point where management began talking about a closer relationship. Morrissey says NetCertive expects to keep Mixpo's 55-person team intact. Prior to the deal, NetCertive's headcount was about 270. NetCertive, according to its Inc. 5000 profile, had $45.1 million in revenue. And on the railroad front comes the article, Richmond is next. As the North Carolina Department of Transportation winds down its Piedmont Improvement Project, a rail revamp from Raleigh to Charlotte, it's pivoting toward an even higher profile effort, the Southeast Rail Corridor from Raleigh to Richmond, Virginia. The project, formerly called the Southeast High-Speed Rail Project, is a long time coming. The Federal Railroad Administration first designated the area between Charlotte and Washington, D.C. as a high-speed rail corridor in 1992. After years of planning, it looks as though higher speeds between Raleigh and Richmond might soon happen, NCDOT Acting Rail Division Director Alan Paul said. Paul cautioned that it's higher speed rail and not high speed, such as what's found overseas. A record of decision, that's a required regulatory hurdle, was finally approved for improvements to accommodate 110-mile-per-hour service along that stretch in March. All environmental documentation is complete. If all goes well, some work could start as early as 2019, though it will likely be several years before the service is fully implemented. The biggest hurdle is funding. It will take a monumental federal and state effort as construction of the improvements needed to implement the Raleigh to Richmond higher speed service will cost about $4 billion, according to NCDOT. Some of the grade separations already have funding earmarks from the state, such as those on Rogers, New Hope Church, and Durant Roads. And in the manufacturing sector comes the article, CEO Robotics Are Everywhere. For Robert Little, CEO of ATI Industrial Automation, rumors about Toyota and Mazda setting up an electric vehicle manufacturing operation in the United States are enticing. But unlike developers who are heavily vying for such a project in North Carolina, ATI will benefit from such a plant, whether it's built here or somewhere else entirely. That's because ATI, which develops robotics for manufacturing, is set up as a global company, serving car makers wherever they create their products. Despite the buzz over domestic manufacturing in recent weeks, manufacturing in the United States is still under fire, Little says. For every plant that opens up here, 10 plants open up in China, and 2 plants open in Mexico. It's a problem people don't quite grasp, he explains. And robotics, many created by his company, are increasingly the technology the manufacturers select, he says. The bottom line is, robotics is becoming more prevalent in the manufacturing arena, he says. Customers are becoming more familiar with the use of robotics, and in doing so, they are buying more of our product. ATI has more than 300 employees and is building a new lab in Apex. Now we move to the Life Sciences page, and the first article from Holly Springs is Plant Ramps Up Flu Vaccine Production. Seqirus continues to increase influenza vaccine production at its Holly Springs site, 2 years after its parent company, CSL, acquired Novartis' global influenza vaccine business for $275 million. Securus, which employs about 550 people in Holly Springs, has quadrupled seasonal influenza vaccine output from 5 million three-strain doses to roughly 20 million four-strain doses from Holly Springs, according to the company. Three-strain doses cover both of the most common A strains of influenza and one B strain. The four-strain doses cover both B strains. One of Sequiris's four-strain vaccines is called Flucelvax. Since Sequiris was formed, our objective has been to transition to Flucelvax and then to rapidly scale up production capability and supply a significant proportion of the Sequiris total influenza vaccine supply from this site, says John Anderson, Sequiris VP of Operations and Holly Springs site lead. Sequiris is part of CSL Limited of Melbourne, Australia. By increasing its seasonal U.S. commercial supply out of Holly Springs, the company is also better positioned when it comes to pandemic doses should one arise, Anderson says. He says that if the company is operating at a higher input when it comes to routine supply, it's simply a matter of switching over to a pandemic supply. Aside from commercial production, the Holly Springs site has had a decade-long partnership with the U.S. government that sees it provide influenza vaccines for the possibility of a large-scale outbreak. Each year, 36,000 people in the U.S. die due to influenza, and more than 200,000 are hospitalized. And on the life sciences front, under the heading of lawsuit, the article Beach Project Challenged in Federal Court. A plan for a rock wall to manage erosion at Ocean Isle Beach is being challenged in federal court. The National Audubon Society, through its state program Audubon North Carolina, has filed a federal lawsuit against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers over the project at the east end of Ocean Isle. Audubon alleges in a complaint filed August 14th in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina that the Army Corps approved a permit for a 1,050-foot rock wall, known as a terminal groin, without properly considering less destructive and less costly alternatives. The project will cost about $6 million. The east end of Ocean Isle Beach is a refuge for not only wildlife, but for families, says Greg Andek, Director of Strategy and Government Relations at the North Carolina Office of the National Audubon Society. In terms of barrier islands off the coast of North Carolina, there are very few remaining natural inlets, he says. The terminal groin is designed to protect buildings immediately west of the structure, Audubon states in its complaint. As a result of stabilizing that small portion of beach, the groin will erode the beach east of the structure and destroy existing recreational beach and wildlife habitat. In some ways, says Andek, these projects simply pass the buck somewhere else. He says that Audubon is seeking an objective look at alternatives to these structures. According to the complaint, the town of Ocean Isle began pursuing permits to construct a terminal groin in 2011. The process yielded a draft environmental impact statement that identified five alternatives to be evaluated, one of which was the terminal groin. The complaint alleges that the Army Corps violated the National Environmental Policy Act by using an inappropriate model to evaluate alternatives, failing to include information necessary to evaluate alternatives, and not evaluating the secondary effects of the terminal groin. And as long as we're in the lawsuit area, here's an article that's called Sharp Words Continue Between Mission Health, BCBSNC. Following Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina's rejection of Mission Health's offer to partially rescind termination of its contracts with the insurer, Mission Health, that's a hospital system that serves 18 counties in western North Carolina, Mission Health has outlined why it will be out of the network effective October 5. We fully accept that given Blue Cross's arbitrary policy of never speaking to any entity that says it will not accept a forever zero automatic renewal, Mission Health will indeed be out of network for Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina's patients indefinitely, beginning October the 5th, said Rowena Buffett-Timms, who is Mission Health's Senior Vice President of Government and Community Relations. The good news is for employers. There are now several different terrific insurer options that will enable them to keep Vision Health in-network while likely saving money. A BCBSNC spokeswoman responded August 15th. If and when Mission decides to lift the termination of its contracts, we would return to discussions on a contract. Early last month, Mission Health announced it planned to cancel its contracts with BCBSNC over payment rate reductions. But then the hospital system went back to BCBSNC with a proposal to partially rescind termination of its contracts and accept BCBSNC's payment rates for ACA members, a proposal the insurer rejected. Mission was completely stunned by Blue Cross's refusal to accept Mission's agreement, to accept exactly what Blue Cross had demanded, said Timms. BCBSNC President and CEO Brad Wilson has said, Mission Health continues to turn its back on senior citizens, state and county employees, businesses, and taxpayers across Western North Carolina. This is unfair to tens of thousands of other members. Therefore, Blue Cross NC has no choice but to reject this offer. Now a couple of articles from the Around the State page. In sports, here's the article, Arnold Palmer's grandson will play golf now, then join the family business. For now, Sam Saunders is content to try to follow his legendary grandfather, Arnold Palmer, as a pro golfer on the PGA Tour. He's put following Palmer's path in the business world on hold. His parents, Amy and Roy, are now busy running the King's businesses. Palmer wouldn't want me to worry about stuff like that, Saunders said August 15th at the unveiling of a plaque honoring Palmer at Sedgefield Country Club, site of the Wyndham Championship. He'd say, go play golf. Palmer won 62 PGA Tour victories, but was also a pioneer in business working with agent Mark McCormick. Beginning in 1960, Palmer transformed himself from sports hero to sports conglomerate. He kind of took golf, or sports in general, from just being a performer to being an endorsable athlete, Saunders said. When Palmer died at age 87 last September, he left an estate valued at $875 million. Also in news from around the state comes the article, Charlotte Law Closes Suddenly. The Charlotte School of Law appears to have closed just before the start of the new academic year. Representatives of the for-profit law school could not be reached for comment August 15th. But an email from Lee Robertson, head of the school's alumni association, confirmed the school's apparent demise. He notes students were informed of the closing August the 15th. It appears that there is no path forward. Our law school, it seems, is closing, effective immediately, Robertson wrote in an email to fellow alumni. Robertson said he spoke with interim dean Paul Meggett earlier this week. He told him that the American Bar Association had denied Charlotte Law's teach-out plan. The University of North Carolina System Board of Governors also declined to grant an extension of the school's license, he adds. Like you, I am deeply saddened and profoundly frustrated by this news. I was very hopeful that our law school would be able to regain the confidence of the ABA, the BOG, its students, and its alumni, Robertson wrote. In a statement August the 15th, North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein said, I want to express my disappointment for the students and their families affected by Charlotte School of Law's failure. While good lawyers have graduated from Charlotte School of Law, the school too often failed to deliver for its students. The news comes less than a year after the school was placed on probation by the ABA over concerns about its admission policy standards and first-time bar passage rates. The U.S. Department of Education cut access to federal student loans last year. The ABA declined to share specifics on where things stand with the school. Now for today's cover story. Articles entitled, Where Have All the Community Banks Gone? A half hour from the sprawl of Raleigh, a centenarian bank is losing its green sign. Four Oaks FinCorp, a bank with $736.7 million in assets, is run by Little League coaches and Sunday school teachers. Four Oaks CEO David Rupp is fond of saying, It's part of being a community bank. Rupp jokes that even 2 years after becoming CEO, he is still on trash duty when the fryers come out for fish fries each year in the branch's asphalt parking lot. After the $10.7 billion asset United Community Banks of Georgia closes on its buy of the form, expected later this year, those fish fries will continue, he insists. But what won't continue is the North Carolina headquarters, and it's not alone. Of the 15 operating banks or bank holding companies headquartered in the Triangle Metro a decade ago, 10 have sold or exited the market, according to SNL Financial Data. This year alone has brought news of a half dozen community bank buys in the state, such as Virginia-based Town Bank's pending buyout of Raleigh's Paragon Commercial and South Carolina-based Carolina Financial Corporation's deal for Washington, North Carolina-based First South Bank. For out-of-state banks, the buys present an opportunity to tap into fast-growing North Carolina. For the community banks they're buying, it means resources to compete with the big guns. For the customers, the communities who have supported the banks, some literally for generations, it means change, and not everyone is optimistic. You do lose that local ownership, that interest in the community, says Tony Plath, professor at UNC Charlotte, explaining that while a community banker might go the extra mile for the community, an out-of-state bank might not do these things and probably won't do those things. With community banks, you do get different lending standards, different preferences, better dedicated monitoring, he says. The little banks know the market better because they're closer to the market. And that raises questions about whether the new owners will fund small businesses, approve loans for minority populations, support charity events, be on local boards, and generally provide the type of funding at a lower level that a larger bank might ignore. While community banks account for just 13% of overall industry assets, they make up 44% of all the small loans to businesses and farms made by all banks in the United States. And that means shifting priorities could cause a major ripple in small businesses across the state. Chris Wren, CEO of All North State Catering in Fuquay Varina, has worked with multiple banking partners and now relies on Raleigh's Fidelity Bank. Should Fidelity ever be required by a large bank, he says he'd have to look at it very hard, as he believes out-of-state entities aren't as interested in smaller communities in North Carolina. I don't hold it against them, he says. It's just the difference between Walmart and Dollar General and the people on the corner, whose families have been here forever. He says he knows his bankers at Fidelity on a personal level. You have local people there who have decision-making capabilities, and they're not calling a headquarters or going by rules that don't take into account those relationships, Wren says. While Fidelity remains independent, some of their community bank peers, feeling the competitive pressures and regulatory burdens, have announced pending buyouts by out-of-state banks. And those banks, during the buying, are aware people like Wren value local relationships. Terry Turner, CEO of Pinnacle Bank, is among those swooping in for a bigger piece of the triangle. His firm, based out of Nashville, Tennessee, recently closed on its acquisition of Bank of North Carolina. And he says he knows the perception challenges when an out-of-state player comes in. He blames cultural mismatch and price tags for bad deals in the industry. When there's a culture mismatch, frontline bankers, the folks who have the personal relationship with the community, jump ship, he says. When a buyer overpays, too big of a cost synergy is required to make the deal effective. And that means job cuts, which damage the service equation, he explains. It's those frontline players that give off the community bank feel, he says. If you have somebody you care about who works at the bank, as long as that person is excited and happy and feels good, you're likely to feel the same way, Turner says. And that's why, when acquiring BNC, Pinnacle tried to preserve front-end employees. More people work at BNC today than when the deal was announced, he says. If you could take two companies and put them together and keep all the revenue and take out whatever the number is, 25 to 30% of the cost, then shareholders make a lot more money, right? He explains. But what happens in practice in many deals to get the cost out of the system, that generally involves taking people out. And when you take people out, you generally use your connectivity to those clients. First South CEO Bruce Elder says part of his strategy as Carolina Financial acquires First South is communicating to customers that those relationships aren't changing. We've been reaching out to our customers and clients ever since the announcement to let them know what's been inspiring and that we're still going to be a community bank, just with greater resources, he says. Most people don't necessarily bank with a bank. They bank with a person. So what we've been communicating to customers is that our relationship managers, our commercial banks and consumer bankers, they're still going to be here. But values are an important issue when banks merge. And Tom Hazen, professor at UNC Chapel Hill School of Law, says that's the way banks should be thinking when they make deals. While not an out-of-state bank, Raleigh's First Citizens has been getting pushback from the CEO of KS Bank Corp, Harold Keene. When First Citizens made two unsolicited offers for the bank known, Keene put out a statement decrying the bank for attempting a hostile takeover, calling the move evidence that the cultures don't align. The corporate culture issue is a very real issue, especially, it seems to me, with a small community bank, Hazen says, noting that one of the things that distinguishes a community bank from a larger bank is that you have that personal contact with your banker. Shareholders looking to cash out shouldn't be the only consideration. They knew they were entering into an illiquid investment. Mergers can come with real consequences for a community, such as branch closures. But that's one reason out-of-state players might offer the community a better deal. When they're entering a new market, there's less overlap, meaning more branches might be preserved in the community. Four Oaks Rupp and Jimmy Talent, chairman and CEO of United Community Banks Incorporated, have said the plan is to grow out the combined bank's presence, securing more Triangle market share in the coming months. But some fear bigger banks don't always have community needs in mind. While acquired banks are worried about losing customers, the surrounding community is worried about the story in reverse, losing a longtime financial partner. In a letter to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Peter Skillern, executive director of Durham-based Reinvestment Partners, makes a case against First Horizon National's buy of Capital Bank Financial Corporation, writing that the deal will undermine the credit needs of underserved communities in North Carolina. We believe that low-income and minority communities will be worse off if the merger is approved, particularly in North Carolina, he writes. He adds that in North Carolina, First Tennessee has concentrated its efforts on serving upper-income geographies and borrowers. According to the letter from 2010 to 2013, First Tennessee originated 114 home purchase and refinance loans in the Winston-Salem Metropolitan Statistical Area and the Raleigh-Caria MSA. Of those, four home purchase and refinance loans were made in moderate income census tracts in the state. The bank did not make any home purchases or refinance loans in low income census tracts in those MSAs over that 4-year period. The letter notes that the bank made 3 home purchases and refinance loans to LMI borrowers. Nearly 79% of the bank's purchase and refinance loans were in upper income census tracts, and 94% went to upper income borrowers, according to the analysis. In the Raleigh-Caria MSA specifically, where First Tennessee has the majority of its North Carolina branches, the bank's lending performance was judged weaker than the bank's overall performance. Just one purchase or refinance loan was originated to an LMI borrower in the metro area from 2010 to 2013, with just one mortgage loan in a moderate income geography. Meanwhile, 87% of mortgage lending went to upper-income borrowers. Reinvestment Partners' report characterizes the bank's record of serving minorities as, quote, alarming, unquote. While African Americans comprise more than 22% of the state's population, First Tennessee had just 2 African American mortgage applications in North Carolina in 2016. Both applications were accepted. Reinvestment Partners points to statistics showing 5.5% of the bank's total mortgage applicants were African American in 2016. Of the 2,036 loans originated by First Tennessee in 2016, just 68 and 28 went to African American and Hispanic borrowers. Nearly 51% and 30.4% of African American and Hispanic mortgage loan applicants, respectively, were denied a loan by First Tennessee, the report says. The statistic drops to less than 24% for white applicants. In response, First Tennessee spokeswoman Kim Cherry said, "Our merger application has received 15 letters of support, including one from Operation Hope, that included more than 100 testimonials from people praising our financial empowerment efforts. We're extremely proud of the support we've received from people in our communities who know First Tennessee well. For 153 years, we have worked to build relationships in these communities where we do business. And these letters reflect that long-standing commitment. We did submit a response that factually refutes the single letter challenging our merger." Community banks are particularly significant in smaller towns. According to the FDIC, more than 20% of the 3,100 counties in the United States have only community banks. But rural areas aren't the draw for the recent bank deals. For example, United Communities Talent is targeting the fast-growing Raleigh Metro, knowing that the metropolitan areas such as the Triangle are obviously where the growth is at. For banks being acquired, the deals are a chance to stay relevant in an increasingly competitive and expensive in terms of regulations environment. We need a bigger balance sheet, Four Oaks Rupp says. 2 years ago, Four Oaks had $820.8 million in assets, more than $80 million more than it does now. But the Triangle banking environment brings competitive pressures, and to compete takes new products and services. So after mulling over options, such as the possibility of a NASDAQ debut, Four Oaks board hired an investment banker to look for partners. It's a similar story elsewhere. We have a mission here at First South to be a high-performing financial institution, a high-performing community bank, says Elder. We believe we could probably get there on our own in another couple of years, but we're partnering with a company that has the same type of community bank values we do. Teaming up with another institution allows for larger loans and shared cost burdens, vital in the current landscape. Other banks share that sentiment. In early 2008, there were 92 banks chartered in the state. By May, there were only 50 banks chartered in the state, 38 commercial banks and 12 savings banks. While 28 banks started between 2003 and 2008, there haven't been any new banks formed in the state since 2009. For one Triangle CEO, consolidation is not in the cards, at least if he has anything to say about it. A lot of banks are created to be sold. Nothing wrong with that, says North State Bank CEO Larry Barber. But we were not created to be sold. It's a sentiment he told the earliest investors. If you want to build to flip, don't give me your money. Barber believes that when an out-of-state institution enters the Triangle with a buy, it's doing it to make itself look more attractive. They can say, "Look, we've got a Triangle footprint," he says. Barber says North State is profitable because of its people, and you can't keep your people with the uncertainty of a buyout looming, he maintains. People also drive the culture, which is key at North State, he says. You only have one culture, and the acquirer wins, he says. There's no such thing as a merger. There's an acquisition. You've sold your culture. You've sold what you were trying to create years ago. This week's Executive Voice features Vincent Price. Vincent is president of Duke University. He has his BA from Santa Clara University, his master's from Stanford, and his PhD from Stanford. His wife, Annette, a daughter, Sarah, and a son, Alexander, originally from Torrance, California. So this is a Q&A with Vincent Price. What attracted you to the school? Duke is a school I had long admired for its energy, creativity, and ambition. So when I was approached about the opportunity to be a candidate for president, my response was quick and enthusiastic. What are your initial observations? First, Duke and Durham have been so friendly in welcoming me and Annette to the community. And second, I've had the advantage, during my transition over the past several months, of being able to meet the students, faculty, staff, and alumni, and learn about Duke's priorities and challenges. These have all confirmed my first impressions that Duke is a remarkably energetic place, with people who care passionately about making a difference in the world. So what are the school's primary opportunities? First and foremost is continuing Duke's ascent as a leader in teaching, learning, service, and healing. We must continue to do everything we can to assure that a Duke education is affordable and accessible for all, regardless of income. We need to look at diversity and inclusion as an essential opportunity, not a burden. And we need to keep bundling support for the role of research universities in society. So how do you see Duke expanding beyond its traditional borders? Duke long ago became a global university, both in experience on campus here in Durham and through our many international programs, especially our medical school in Singapore and Duke Kunshan University in China. We will continue to develop those centers and look for new opportunities carefully and strategically. At the same time, technology allows us to expand the university's footprint in very exciting ways, and I look forward to identifying means by which we can continue to innovate on that front. So what opportunities do you see online? Online learning will not replace the Duke experience on campus, but it can enhance education and research and make the intellectual resources of the university readily available to many new audiences. What advice has former President Richard Broadhead given you? Duke has been blessed with great presence going back decades. Dick Broadhead was a transformational leader for Duke who is widely respected within higher education. In our time together during the transition, he offered wise counsel on a range of topics, among the many wonderful things he's passing along to me as I follow him in this role. Tuition is a key concern for families. How can Duke balance the need to fund its programs and attract the best students? This is a central challenge for Duke and universities like it. We've long been committed to having a need-blind admissions policy. That is, we admit students without regard to their ability to pay, and we also meet the full demonstrated financial need of all students as long as they are enrolled. That commitment cost the university more than $140 million last year, and is only possible with the continued support of donors who believe in it as passionately as we do. So after the successful Duke Forward campaign, what are the key priorities? Part of my own freshman orientation is getting briefed on those plans and looking at how they will continue to drive Duke forward. Make no mistake, the success of Duke Forward is a great inheritance for a new president and one that will be well invested. So what's a key lesson you've learned? Never stop listening. Your 1992 book, Public Opinion, examined the impact and nature of public opinion. Will your research be reflected in your role as president? My interest in public opinion is rooted in a desire to understand how people, a nation, and a community identify problems and, with no consensus about how to address them, work through their disagreements by reading, writing, and talking about them. It has highlighted for me the critical need for open and respectful communication in making thoughtful, informed community choices, something I hope to promote as president. So what books affected you? I've recently read Earl Porter's Trinity and Duke, along with Robert Durden's The Dukes of Durham and The Launching of Duke University. They impressed upon me the remarkable opportunity I've been given. Duke has a rival school nearby. Has that come up? Toward the end of my first meeting with the Presidential Search Committee, which was a wonderful and engaging discussion, it was brought to my attention that my tie was not, shall we say, the correct shade of blue. Indeed, it was that other blue. I'll not make that mistake twice. And today's small business page features an article written by Edward Marshall, who's an adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. His article is entitled, Maintaining a Moral Compass Essential in Business. Unethical leadership seems to be in the air. What do Uber, Wells Fargo, Mylan, Volkswagen, and Takata have in common? It's a lack of ethical leadership. Each of these companies has found themselves in ethical, legal, regulatory, and financial trouble that has significantly impacted their reputations and their bottom lines. And while these are the ones in the news, there are far too many leaders who are behaving as if financial gain is the only measure of success. It's not. But unethical leadership can be extremely costly. It cost Wells $185 million and its reputation to defraud more than 2 million customers. It will likely take years to recover. Andrew Lee, in his 2013 book, Ethical Leadership, notes that a lack of leadership ethics can destroy the company and its reputation, reduce access to capital markets, drive down stock prices, result in government fines and regulations, audit and oversight, result in lawsuits and customer defections, and produce employee cynicism and turnover. In fact, another study by Linda Trevino in the book Managing Business Ethics found that 1 in 3 employees left their jobs because of the company's ethics. It simply doesn't pay to be unethical. This is a call for a return to leading with a moral compass, where our principles govern our behavior, where our integrity is more important than cutting corners or a few more bucks. It involves more than having a code of ethics or a value statement on the wall or in the HR handbook. Leading with a moral compass means leadership turns ethical principles into visible actions, commitments, and behavior. It means creating a leadership culture that has at its fundamental premise that every employee, no matter what their rank, will act honorably and above reproach. In addition, it means setting the tone across the organization, creating psychological safety so that the workforce will speak truth to power about unethical conduct, evaluating ethical risks, actively engaging the workforce in a conversation about ethical behavior, performance management that rewards ethical behavior, and accountability systems, monitoring, and oversight. It's time we restore the highest set of ethical leadership in every business. That ultimately means it starts at the top, is the essence of the leadership culture, and is made real in actions and accountability. And in today's Viewpoint page comes an article called Why This Tax Rule Must Be Protected. Efforts to improve the competitiveness of U.S. companies often focus on how we tax U.S. companies on the income they earn in foreign markets. For example, calls for a lower corporate rate and a territorial tax system in which income earned by U.S. companies in foreign markets is excluded from U.S. tax are often motivated by a desire to boost exports or the worldwide share of income earned by American companies. But that focus has overshadowed a more important and simpler to solve problem of how to improve the competitiveness of U.S. businesses in our own market by limiting the substantial tax advantage we offer foreign-owned companies right here in the U.S. There should be a broad agreement not to give tax advantages in our domestic market to companies whose headquarters and factories are abroad in Europe, Asia, or a Caribbean tax haven. That's why the decision by the Trump administration to revisit and delay components of Treasury's 385 earnings stripping regulations is hard to fathom. Without the regulations, American-owned businesses will be worse off. The regulations targeted a major tax advantage foreign competitors have over U.S. businesses in our home market, that is, the ability to avoid U.S. corporate taxes via interest stripping. U.S. and foreign-owned companies are supposed to pay the same rate of tax from income earned in the U.S. But in an interest-stripping transaction, a foreign company loads up its U.S. subsidiary with debts owed to its foreign parent, or more often a shell company established in a tax haven. The interest paid by the U.S. subsidiary is deductible against U.S. taxable income, but the tax haven country doesn't tax the interest received. By cranking up purported interest payments, a company can drive its U.S. tax base to zero while still keeping all the profits within the larger company. Purely domestic U.S. firms can engage in such activities, and U.S. multinationals pay tax on passive income, like interest received, whether earned in the U.S. or in the Cayman Islands, so the scope of avoidance from U.S. companies is much smaller. Unlike other problems of the corporate tax, the disadvantage that U.S. firms face is not about whether the U.S. firms are taxed on business income earned abroad, nor is it the result of the U.S. rate, which applies equally to domestic and foreign firms on their U.S. activities, even at a lower corporate rate. American companies would remain at a disadvantage. The practical result of interest stripping is that a U.S. company operating on one street corner, that's a retailer, grocer, consulting firm, manufacturer, pays full freight 35% tax on the profits it earns, while the company across the street vying for the same customers may pay nothing. The result is that the foreign-owned firm can underprice or outspend its U.S. competition to expand its operations or bring in more clients. The headquarters and production jobs that support the expanded market share are more likely to be overseas. The tax advantage is so large that interest stripping is the primary reason why companies invert or relocate their residence overseas, and it fuels foreign acquisitions of U.S. businesses. In effect, we pay foreign investors to take over our companies with our own tax dollars. The day after an inversion, the U.S. company is loaded with related party debt, driving down its taxable income. Months or years later, however, the real cost of the transfer to foreign ownership may be even larger. Less investment in U.S. operations, the U.S. workforce, or the local community. Enter the 385 regulations named for the relevant section of the tax code. The rules targeted fabricated financial transactions between parents and subsidiaries intended to produce interest deductions, limiting the ability to strip interest and the incentives to invert. They hoped to level the playing field between U.S. and foreign-owned competitors and reduce the primary incentive for U.S. companies to invert and move their headquarters and key operations abroad. The U.S. Treasury estimated the rule would stop about $7.4 million of tax avoidance over the next decade, much of it from inverted companies. Eliminating interest stripping and inversions is a bipartisan objective. Someday we will renovate our business tax code to remove the incentives and ability for corporations to dodge U.S. taxes. But until we do, the 385 regulations are essential. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.